Hello, sports world, and welcome to the debut episode of Sideline Sessions with Wesley Sykes. I am, of course, Wesley Sykes, the managing editor of Coach and Athletic Director, Training and Conditioning, and Winning Hoops Brands for Great American Media Services. In this brand new podcast series, we will be speaking with industry professionals from high school and college coaches to athletic trainers and strength coaches to basketball trainers to athletic administrators and maybe, just maybe, a few professional athletes along the way. This will be a bi-monthly or bi-weekly or every other week podcast that could be listened to anywhere podcasts can be downloaded in the very near future, as well as our websites, coachandad.com, training-conditioning.com, and winninghoops.com. And if you're not already, you can follow us on Twitter at CoachAD and at TrainCondition and Winning Hoops. And you can follow me as well at Wesley Sykes _ to stay up to date on everything that's happening in the sports world. For this week's episode, we welcome Aaron Struthers, assistant men's basketball coach for UMass Dartmouth, a Division III program. Aaron has played at all three levels of the game at a high level, and I can think you can tell his passion from the game here. And this is someone that I've worked with in closely over the years, and someone who, again, I think you can tell his passion from the game. He has been a standout high school player in the state of Massachusetts that went on to earn a Division II scholarship to Merrimack College, which I know is Division I now, but at his time, mid-2000s, I believe he was a 2012 graduate. It was still Division II, and then went on to play internationally for the Cape Verdean national team for a little bit, as well as Costa Rica as well. So this is someone who has, again, played at all three levels of the game, is a student of the game, has a high basketball IQ, and knows a lot about it. So I hope you enjoy this interview, and stay tuned for our next episode, which will be coming out, I believe, on November 5th, if I have my dates correct. And again, we'll be announcing that guest in the near future, so please stay tuned to that. And again, enjoy Aaron Struthers, because here he is. All right, great. So yeah, it says we're recording. You see the live button in there, right? So
wait, where does it say that?
It should be in the top left-hand corner for you. I don't know if it has a different interface on, on like an iPad or something. But anyway, we're going live here, so I'm just going to mark the time when we start.
It's in the link there, I think.
Oh, nice. Okay. All right. Perfect. Okay. So we will start in, let's see, 3, 2, 1. All right. Welcome to the program, Aaron. Thanks for being our inaugural guest on Sideline Sessions here. Now, Aaron Struthers, as I already mentioned, is the assistant coach for UMass Dartmouth basketball and in charge of recruiting for the Division III program. So, Aaron, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for inviting me up here. It's great. It's a pleasure to be a part of this.
Yeah, so we obviously have a little bit of background history, both hailing from Massachusetts and the South Coast region there. But and we also work together. If you ever wanted to head over to winninghoops.com, Aaron was nice enough to spend some time with me and give me some recruiting tips of what college coaches look for in high school players when they're looking to make that jump to the next level. So definitely go give that a check out, and we're going to be talking about some of that here today. And I think, with your experience as a college recruiting assistant, as well as an AAU coach, that kind of brings you a unique perspective of seeing both sides of the high school game, as well as the college game. And what do you look for in young players when that could make a quality, Division III player for you?
Yeah, so first and foremost, I always pay real close attention to body language. There's a lot of players that they're running and gunning. They want to score a lot of points, and they think that's the most important thing, which, of course, that is important. We need players that can score. We love players that can score. At UMass Dartmouth, especially, we play fast. But body language is key. So body language when you're on the court, body language when you're on the bench. How does the player respond when the coach is really yelling at him, or if his teammate falls to the ground, is he helping his teammate up? You know, if he makes a nice, good pass and his teammate fumbles it, is he, you know, hands up in the air, or is he, it's okay, next play. So I like that because that really shows the attitude of the player.
Yeah, and I think, that's definitely a huge thing, like you said, how they interact with teammates, opposing players, if you're at a road game, how they interact with, the opposing rowdy fans, and even the referees to a point, right? I think that having that that respect for a game, for the game, as you're going to be representing the school in many different situations when you have that jersey on the court, right? So I think that's something that all coaches should probably look for first and foremost, maybe above the talent.
Yeah, no, and referees too. That's a big one, because and I referee a little bit on the side. I don't have much ref experience, but even refereeing, I've refed AAU, so I've played AAU, I've refed AAU, and recruited at AAU events, and I've never been a player to really talk back to a referee, so that's one thing that kind of just I really is a turnoff if someone's questioning or crying to the referee or giving the referee any kind of attitude.
Yeah, I think it's funny. I've done little league umpiring as a kid, and that was always tough too, because the strike zone and everything, and then everyone's a major league pitching coach out there in the stands and everything. But I think that's also a pretty unique perspective of being able to be someone who's played the game. At all three levels, coached and also referee. Do you have what's that perspective of dealing with a referee, having been one yourself?
Well, like I said, I never really been one to give a ref a hard time, but it wasn't until I refed that I realized how hard it is to referee. There's a lot of calls and referees, players, coaches, like we're all humans. And we're going to make mistakes. So maybe that referee made a mistake, but from the referee's perspective, you're confident in that call. That's your call that you made, and you're sticking with it, and your partner's better be backing you up also.
Yeah, I think teamwork definitely comes in play when you're refereeing as well, and more than just playing there. You got to make sure you guys are on the same team there. Getting back to some of the recruiting stuff, when you talk to these players, maybe before or after, you kind of have this one-on-one or maybe with a coach or a parent in some cases. What do you look for out of that those conversations? Obviously, they're got to that point because they have some sort of talent to get you on their radar. But what are you looking for after that point?
Yeah, so going into it, I like to introduce myself to the coach prior to the game, if possible. Sometimes I won't really. The kid's getting ready for the game. I'm not really going to bother him before the game. Plus, if I haven't seen him play yet,
but right?
but I do want to make that connection with the coach, though. Whether this kid is really a high profile recruit of mine or not, maybe that coach might have a high recruit next year. So I do want to start to build that relationship with the high school coach or the AAU coach, whichever it may be. And after the game, the parents are usually one of the first people to go talk to their son. So if I can make that introduction, that's also great. So I like to the first interaction, I tried to make it kind of light. Mm-hmm. Let him know that we're there and definitely compliment his game. Mm-hmm. Everyone loves compliments,
You definitely ease up at that, right? Yeah. You don't get the hardball questions, as soon as you pay me a compliment.
Exactly. So you give him some, and I'm not gonna just gonna say good game. Hey, I like the way you rebounded the ball, or I like the way you, I don't know, you stole it at half court, then went down and dunked it. Like, get specific. Let him know that you're really paying attention. I think that's important. Also, I'm not just there. Like, I'm really watching you play, and I'm watching everything. That also.
So how, and I'm sure this has come across where you have your, a certain player that when you enter a high school gym that you're keeping an eye on, and you're certainly watching, this player A, for example, But throughout the course of the game, you're watching the whole game unfold, and you know, maybe it's the sixth man on that team or someone from an opposing team that catches your eye. You know, how do you kind of navigate that, you know, with going into seeing one player and the possibility of coming out and seeing, you know, a couple other players? You know, how do you kind of divide your time up during the game when making evaluations like that?
Yep. Actually, that's a very good question, Wes.
Thanks. Yeah. So you're paying me compliments now, and now I'm not going to give you the hard questions. See what we're doing. It's good. That's good.
Yep. But yeah, because there's times. Okay, so first, if I've already made contact and I'm going to the game, and someone else catches my eye, after the game, I want to make contact with the person that I've already made contact with, because I've already started to build that relationship. So you definitely, you already know that he's a recruit and you like him and you've had that contact. So you don't want him to see you going to talk to someone else before you even talk to him.
Right.
You know? So, but if there's been situations where, you know, I go to see a kid but I haven't made that connection to him and he's pretty good, but someone else catches my eye. So now I'm thinking, okay, all right, now I got to talk to both of these guys after the game. And if it's his teammate, I can talk to him. If it's, you know, breaking the ice first time, I can kind of talk to them together. You know, sometimes players are in a rush. It's an away game that they're trying to go. Mm-hmm. But the important thing is asking them, you know, you're not trying to get them to commit right off the jump. I mean, of course, all coaches would love that.
Yeah.
But just ask him if he's interested at all. And that's important. And the other, if it's an opponent, then I want to try to talk to him also. There's no guideline for when I'm going to talk to the kid. It's really, sometimes, you know, you plan things to say and it just, the conversation doesn't go that way.
So, right. So
really it's feeling it out, feeling if the kid is interested and getting that contact information. So I want to get the phone number. I'm going to give you my phone number. And so we can start to build that relationship and hopefully keep it going from there. But yeah, definitely, getting the contact information and seeing, hey, are you interested? And then, you know, as time goes on, it's like, okay, how are your grades? You know, that's right. Also, it's student athlete, you know, the students first. So if the kid's failing or you better get those grades up or you can't even play in college.
Right. It's not even a conversation at that point. Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, when you're getting back to, some of the games between the lines here, when it comes to UMass Dartmouth, you said they like to play fast, playing in the Little East Conference, a competitive Division III conference, excuse me, in the Northeast. You know, what do you look for out of players that would translate well to maybe fit your game and your style with head coach Brian Baptiste?
Yeah, so like we run a lot of fast breaks. We want to push it. We do some motion. Won't get too specific with our plays.
Yeah.
So someone that can run the floor, especially if it's a big, bigs are hard to find for Division III as it is. And if there's a big that can run the floor, but a guard that can control the break and push it, has his heads up, always looking for his teammate, things of that such, that definitely is like key things that I look for.
And then how about is there something like that you look for that really jumps out again, like kind of playing that two-way game or, you know, someone who's going to be, flashing that athleticism on the defensive side of the court, you know, offhand finishing moves, things like that. Like, you know, what part of the game right now do you think translates best for a high school player, you know, making that jump to the D3 level?
To put it into one word is really, I mean, obviously we're talking about someone that I know can play. Is he coachable?
Mm-hmm.
And that, like you can be the most skilled, but if you're not getting along with your teammates, it messes the whole chemistry up. And if you're not coachable, you're not going to be able to improve, and you're not going to be able to gel with the team. And doesn't matter how good you are. We're looking for a piece that's going to add to what we're already building.
Yeah, and you know, you're someone who has plenty of experience, adding that leadership and that scoring ability to teams, throughout all levels, high school, college, at the Division II level with Merrimack, and then even playing overseas for the Cape Verdean national team, out in Costa Rica as well. But we'll go back in the way back machine to your high school days, 1,200 plus points. Yeah, I had you averaging 26, 10, and 6 blocks your senior year for Wareham. But coming in, it appeared, at least from my research, that you were a highly touted middle school kid, above 6 feet already before hitting high school. Had dreams of, or maybe goals of, making varsity fresh out of tryouts, and that didn't necessarily go your way early on, right? You spent some time on the freshman team, on the JV team, and slowly worked your way up varsity by the end of your freshman year. But how did you handle that adversity of, hey, thinking I'm going to be, on varsity freshman year, and have to work your way up to that and maybe reassess some goals?
Yeah. So, like eighth grade, I was 6 feet. Certainly I believed that I was like, okay, next year I'm going to high school. I should be, and I will be playing varsity. And there was two other kids in my grade who were tall, not as tall as me, but they were tall, and what they had that I didn't have is I was scrawny. So I was real skinny, and they had some more meat on their bones. They were stronger than me physically. And that freshman year came, and I think one or two of them kind of got that automatic jump to JV. Mm-hmm. So I had to play on the freshman team, and I definitely took that personal. So I used it as motivation, because in my head I knew that I was better than them. Not to be too cocky or anything, but
well, I think that's the mentality you have to have, though, if you're going to be going as far as you've had in your career, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I still got love for those guys, of course. Actually, but at the time, I was like, man, they made it and not me. And so it motivated me to really. I was like, well, there's only one thing. There's only two things you can do. You can kind of hang your head, and this is where I'm at, or you buckle down and you put in the work and you work your way up. So I worked out sometimes. There was an assistant coach that would bring me before high school to the YMCA. We just had a YMCA built not too long ago. Mm-hmm. When I was in high school at the time. So before high school, I would go and get shots up. And there wasn't many high school players doing that at the time. And that was one thing, because yeah, I was a big, but I wanted to shoot too. So like the mid range was kind of like, all right, if I can get this part of my scoring ability, it'll really set me apart. And every coach is going to want to play me.
And it's funny you say the mid range. That you go back to like that's what mid early 2000s when you're coming up in high school. So the mid range jumper hadn't been eliminated from the game yet. It wasn't just threes and layups at that point. There was value in the mid range still, right?
Absolutely. So I worked my mid range and that kind of, and I was like, well, these guys are stronger than me, but they're not faster than me. So I can use that to my advantage also. So mm-hmm. I was skinny, but I was fast and I was tall. So running the floor, whether it was sprints, like I don't care if some coaches, they set the guards to run and then they set the bigs to run, whichever it was, I was trying to make sure that I came in first. Mm-hmm. So if there's sprint, like I'm coming in first, I want to have that stamina. And I want that fast break. If I'm running the floor, I can get that. That's an easy 2 points. So I used what I was good at, and I used what I could. Instead of trying to back someone down, I'm like, I'm gonna beat him down the floor, and he's gonna be winded, and I'm gonna have all that stamina. I didn't want my coach to take me out of the game because he thought I was winded. That was one thing. So mm-hmm. So if you can prove to your coach that, hey, I'm coming in first place in all my sprints, like you see me getting after it in practice, don't take me out because you think I'm tired. Like I'm trying to get all that 40 minutes.
Right. Right. So
that, yeah.
And a couple things that I just found interesting is one, that you had an assistant coach take the time out, you know, out of their schedule to see something in you to, you know, wake up at 5-6 o'clock in the morning, whatever it was before high school, to get shots up with you. You know, that's not time that they're necessarily on the clock, you know? So I think to be able to have someone like that, you know, as a coach now, it's got to be something you can appreciate. And the other thing is, I think, you know, finding what you can do, what maybe your competition on your team can't do, right? If you had these guys who maybe were similar height, but, you know, a little bit more filled out than you, maybe a traditional back to the basket type of guy, you know, maybe your way to do it is rim running the floor and getting that mid-range going and finding your way where you can help the team out. I think that's, you know, takes a lot of wherewithal at a young age to be able to spot that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, like I said, I was motivated and I was like, yeah, I'm going to play. So whatever it is I got to do, add to my game or use as my strengths. And that's what I was going to do. So, yeah. So I started out freshman year. My freshman year was a long year. I started out playing freshman, averaged a lot, played very well. They moved me up to JV, I don't know, midseason or something like that. And, or whatever. And then, played well there also. And then it wasn't until the very end of the season, that my freshman year, and they were like, all right, let's give him a shot on varsity.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think,
yeah, I played a couple. Yeah.
So what's that level of importance? You know, you hear this so often with athletes that use, you know, a chip on their shoulder or kind of finding any sort of reason, maybe to feel slighted as a form of motivation. You know, so to go through that, you know, that minor setback, you know, do you think that kind of helps set you up, you know, for the rest of your high school career and going on to Merrimack? And do you think that's important for athletes to kind of have, you know, an early adversity, early obstacles to go through, you know, in their playing careers?
Absolutely. I think absolutely. It helped me. And I think the way you look at it is it's going to make or break you. And it certainly wasn't breaking me. So, mm-hmm. So, you know, you got to do what you got to do. And I believed it. And I just put in the work and I just wanted it. I just wanted it. And that's going to see what kind of player are you? Do you want it or not? So, and if you take that little setback or you didn't make the team or, you know, the infamous story of Jordan getting cut.
Right. Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, it humbles you. And it's like, okay, I was in middle school. I was one of the best players on the team. I could have just coasted right along through. Mm-hmm. But being set back and I was like, whoa, well, all right, there's a lot more work to do.
Yeah. And I think it showed, I think you put in that work, right? Cause you go off, you end up, you know, like I said, scoring 1200 points in high school, right? Holding the record for a certain amount of a couple of years, for school record for points. Am I correct at that? Wareham High School. And I also saw one game, you just had 20 points off dunks alone. You know, which is kind of a cool feat. So, you know, Wareham is a, you know, not a huge school. I'm not sure at that point if they're Division II or Division III in Massachusetts, but, you know, kind of a small, you know, you were kind of a big fish in a small pond. And I think you even described yourself that in a few stories that I read. And it wasn't until your junior year when you started playing AAU teams and, you know, New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, some of the other, you know, states around the Northeast, where you saw some of that other talent and what else was out there and what it would take, you know. And again, what did that moment tell you, you know, about what you need to do if you wanted to, you know, go on and play in college?
Yeah. So, yeah, it definitely was a big fish in a small pond. And it wasn't until there was another player that, I don't know if you're familiar, but Kobe Santos, he's actually the, coach at Bishop Stang.
My alma mater, of course.
Yeah, so he's actually from the same neighborhood as me. So, but mm-hmm. he's older than me, And I never was like a like I love playing and I love performing and working on my craft, but what made me take it kind of like set the goal to get the idea in my head was seeing him like, oh, he just got a scholarship to go to college. Like, and that just made it like a real reality. I didn't know anyone else that was playing in college, like no older siblings or anything. Like I wasn't even really thinking about college at all. Actually, I didn't apply to college. And graduating Wareham, I didn't apply to college. I was set on getting that scholarship. So, and fortunately, I decided to play AAU, and I was like, I'm going all in now. So I started playing AAU my junior year, and that's when I started to build the relationship with the prep school coach, and then eventually going to prep school in Connecticut. So that gave me another year. I did a post grad year. You still there?
Oh yeah, I'm still here. I got you. Yeah,
Okay.
so you're at Marianapolis, right? You go to a Class B NEPSAC championship game. You know, NEPSAC's obviously getting some love with Duncan Robinson going to the NBA finals recently. So you know, it's nice to see some New England talent getting some recognition there. But you know, you use that year wisely, right? You get a good look from Merrimack, which was then a Division II school, now a Division I school. And what was that difference again, making that jump up to that next level in gameplay, you know, from high school AAU prep school level to, you know, that Division II college?
So like being a big fish in a small pond and then playing AAU, that just opens up your eyes. So, playing AAU, Connecticut, New Jersey, New York, and going against guys that are huge. And again, I was like, all right, I'm going against big guys. Like I really gotta run the floor. And like there's one name that always sticks out is Samardo Samuels.
Oh
I
yeah.
think you went to play at Louisville maybe.
Yeah, I think he played on the Cavs too, right? He had a ticket in the NBA for a little bit.
I don't even know, but that's just one guy I remember battling against in high school and being like, wow, there's so much more out there. And again, I was like, yeah, I got a lot of work to do. So being at prep school, it was cool being a post grad because I didn't have to, like, I already graduated high school. So the classes that I took were more of like filler classes and electives. I still had to take English and a math and stuff like that. But so I could really focus on the basketball and as opposed to, focusing on the school and the basketball. And also you're living up there. So you're not hanging out with your friends from town and being distracted and stuff like that. It's not like college where there's no girls in your dorm room and stuff like that.
Yeah, a little different, right? Not exactly high school at that point, but not exactly the total freedom and fun that you would have at college, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so we mentioned that you were 6 feet in middle school. You sprouted, right? You filled out to 6'7", which is, you know, I would say for the college game and the high school game is tall, but when you're thinking about professionals, you know, that's not what you can consider or usually think of when you think of a shot blocker. But yet you have a pretty good knack for shot blocking, right? I was looking over some stats. You had what, 57 one year, almost 60 another year at Merrimack. So what's the secret to getting a good clean block? And you know, what was your favorite type of block? Is it like the LeBron James chase down on a, you know, a fast break, or you know, coming over from the weak side and offering help? Or you know, take me through how you like to block a shot.
So, the I did get a lot of blocks, and the thing, if I had to say, and this is something I try to teach, but it's really, it's tough to teach because it's really all the timing, and but if I had to give one tip, it would be take the hit, like with your chest and have your arms up, and then time the jump. So those are my favorite kind of blocks when someone's trying to drive on you and they're trying to like, 'cause I'm skinny. So people who try to like pull me over, I just take that hit with my chest and then just jump up and send it right back. So those are my favorite kind of blocks. The chase down blocks, you know, of course, that shows a lot of athleticism and timing as well. And the help side block, you know, that's kind of like a sneak attack. Mm-hmm. those ones look cool too, but I like it straight up. Just, yeah, come at me. I'm gonna take that hit and I'm gonna punch it back.
Now, is it a preferred hand? Because, you know, I'm a lefty player. So sometimes I feel like when people drive on me and they don't necessarily know when I'm playing, you know, old man pickups or stuff like that and stuff. So nothing too crazy. But, you know, I feel like having that left hand against a typical right-handed shooter gives me a little bit more of an advantage. I don't know if that means anything, but, you know, being able to block right on right, is there a difference, or a left on right or left on lefty shot?
Yeah, so most players are righty, so naturally your left hand is gonna be closer, but I don't know, maybe it was just instincts. I never really thought about which hand to block with. It's really just about that timing and taking that first hit.
And is it true, right? I mean, you want to keep the wrist straight too, right? That's kind of like a basic thing to not, especially if you're absorbing the contact like that, or maybe you don't leave your feet as fast enough, right? You want to keep those hands up and just not let them break.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you don't want to get in foul trouble. You know, you don't want to be the big man on the bench because you got four fouls and now you can't even help your team win.
Right.
So there were some games, you know, I did get in some foul trouble. it comes with the blocks, but yeah, just absolutely, you want to keep your arms up and your hands up to avoid that.
So I think this has got to be a momentous moment in your personal and professional career. But getting to play for the Cape Verdean national team with a couple of hometown friends for the most part, right? And Brian Rudolph and Denzel Brito. What did that mean to you, and what was that experience, right? I think when we talked previously, that was what, about a month or 6 weeks or so, playing over in Africa along the Ivory Coast.
Yeah. So, I mean, that opportunity was priceless and yeah, it was 2013. So I actually, I was class of 2012 from Merrimack. I was one class short. And I wanted to make sure I didn't want to put that on the back burner. I wanted to make sure I got that bachelor's. So so I waited to play until I completed that class. And then so 2013, that summer, and I got the call. Yeah, so Brian Rudolph and Denzel Brito, both two guys who I've played alongside with and still play every summer, or every men's league or whatever it is, money tournaments and stuff like that. But the opportunity to go to Cape Verde was just so priceless, because I'm Cape Verdean and my parents have never been to Cape Verde. Both my parents are Cape Verdean. My grandparents are both, three out of the four are Cape Verdean and they've never been to Cape Verde. So as a generation, and it's like, that's why I can't speak Creole, because I'm like fourth generation here. Mm-hmm. and no one has gone back. So I'll remember that and cherish that for the rest of my life. We played in played in Praia and São Vicente, two different islands in Cape Verde. For anyone that doesn't know, Cape Verde is 10 islands off the coast of Africa. And it turned out that there was a problem with some of the paperwork that was beyond my control. So I played with the Cape Verde national team, but when it came down, like after a little over a month, I wasn't able to actually compete in the tournament. So it was kind of a bummer, but you know, I got a month and some change out of it and the experience of a lifetime.
Yeah. And again, and just, you know, the places that basketball can take you when you put in the time and effort. Again, getting a shot to play overseas in Costa Rica too. You know, I think everyone usually thinks of the NBA when you go pro, maybe not so much now with, you know, some of the bigger European leagues and the NBL kind of getting the Lonzo Ball treatment and everything, or the LaMelo Ball treatment in recent years. But, you know, playing overseas is a real viable option for a lot of, you know, Division I, Division II, Division III players who don't get drafted and don't go to the G League. And, you know, so I think that's a tremendous opportunity. What is that like playing overseas for maybe anyone who might be considering that, and maybe any misconceptions that you had prior to going over there that you could dispel?
Yeah, so like most basketball players, you know, you don't want to give it up. So, but at the same time, you have a lot of real life coming at you. As soon as you're out of college, it's the real life. Even if you're playing, it's still the real life. And so yeah, you have a lot of like society kind of, I feel like society kind of pushes you to, you know, you just want to, you set certain goals for yourself kind of, cause you're growing and maturing into your own man yourself. So I feel like society kind of like, you know, you want that. I want a job that's going to pay 100K. Like,
right.
Or you might meet someone and then it's like, well, am I going to get married in a couple years? Do I want to be overseas? And so all that life stuff and, you know, you might move out. Now you're paying rent and bills are starting. Okay. I need a car. Now I got the car bills and stuff like that. So dealing with all that stuff, I from the jump, I was like, I want to play. I know I want to play. I want to experience. I love traveling. And, I had a teammate who was from Costa Rica and he was going back to Costa Rica the same year, like 2013-14. So it worked out perfectly. So I went and played in Costa Rica with him. So I played with my teammate from college and I played in his home country in Costa Rica. So it was funny because my, you know, Thanksgiving break for college, he's not going back to Costa Rica. He would come to my house.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah.
Meet my family and my friends from my hometown and stuff like that. So me playing in Costa Rica, it was like the roles just reversed. And now
right.
I'm meeting his family all down there, his friends. And we had a pretty good season. Costa Rica isn't, you know, nothing like high level Europe, but I was living and I was experiencing and just came back with a little bit of change, not a big amount, but again, that opportunity was priceless.
But I get, yeah, like you said, in your early 20s, post college, you know, and you still got that time where, you know, you probably don't have to have everything figured out at that moment. So, you know, go and travel the world and pursue what you love before, you know, things really do have to start getting serious and you have to buckle down and pay bills and just be an adult, do the 9-to-5 thing. Right. So if you have that opportunity, right, I think that's a great one to take. So, yeah. And again, get to see the world a little bit as well. Tell me about Village Hoops now. So this is a side project that you've been working on, right? You know, what is it? What do you hope to accomplish with Village Hoops? And what was the idea behind it?
So, it's actually a good transition because like going into the real world also, like my main motive for building the Village Hoops community and that's the way I view it is like a real community. And I want to build that community and kind of be a resource for anyone that's playing or coaching or refereeing or anything like that. And really Village Hoops is documenting my basketball journey. So like I've started, you know, like I mentioned, like, you know, you got bills and you want to work. So I was working and then I was like, well, I got to do something basketball. So I started volunteer coaching and one thing led to another. I was volunteer coaching in my hometown. And then I was volunteer travel coaching. And then I was coaching AAU. And then I got the opportunity to apply for the UMass Dartmouth position. And so this is my fourth year at UMass Dartmouth. And, and I'm like, hey, like, I feel like the way that social media is these days, everybody can have their brand. If you're passionate about something and like whether, I don't know, maybe you don't like being on the camera, you can write a blog or do a podcast like we're doing now or something like that. But I think it's important to start documenting and putting the stuff out there, because when people see it and you know the people and there's kids looking up to you and they see it like real life, like I seen that kid, like, oh, he's a coach. Like I want to be a coach, or he's playing in college. I want to play in college. And that's real. The brand in a nutshell is pretty much it. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think it goes back to, you know, what we were saying earlier in our conversation when you mentioned Colby Santos, you know, and he was the first person to kind of put that idea in your head that, hey, we're both from the same area. I can go to college and play in college too, right? So that was kind of the same idea. And the idea with Village Hoops, I think, is great because for those of you who may be unfamiliar with the town of Wareham, within the town of Wareham, there is a small village called Onset, right, which is where you guys are from. And there's about, 8 to 10 basketball players all around, you know, our age, who all not only dominated, Wareham and local high schools in the area, but went on to do great things in college and play overseas as well. That I find to be very unique. Just the high rate of amount of successful basketball players to come from a small town. Even if you want to throw in, you know, Stephen Cooper, you know, NFL linebacker, right? He's an Onset guy too, right?
Yep. Yeah, exactly. So Onset, Onset's really a special place. I know it's my hometown, so I'm biased, but
sure. But good reason.
It truly is. And they did an article in the paper, it was some years back, but just talking about how the close proximity of Onset, it's a small town, that's why they call it a village, but we loved basketball growing up and we all pushed each other and we played like that's all that like our generation is kind of like the last of the play outside generation.
Yeah.
And of course kids do now, but we didn't have smartphones growing up. So to be from Onset and I want people just to know like this is a special place and that's why I named my brand Village Hoops after Onset Village. And there's two of my friends right now, Jordan Resendiz and Denzel Brito. They're playing right now overseas currently. So one's in Spain and one's in Germany. And it's unbelievable. A lot of the core team that won the Wareham State Championship in 2010, some of those guys were from Onset also. Mm-hmm. It's a special place.
Yeah, you did. You referenced that story that was written a while back. I would be remiss if I didn't tell you that was me who wrote that story. I wrote that. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah, from the Standard Times. It took a village, right? And it was a front page of the paper. Yeah, that was me. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's crazy.
That's great, right? It's a couple of years ago.
I still have that article. And if for anyone else that's listening that's from the area, that article is kind of what sparked the mission of rebuilding the Onset courts.
Oh, so no kidding. Really?
Yeah. So thank you, Wes, for that. Because,
because
I like that article, like, and I was like, yo, like we grew up playing on this court. We had our court, our Onset Village court. There's two courts that we like mainly played on, but the one that we like really, really played on, the rim was probably 8.5 feet. Like that's how old it was. and it wasn't the adjustable hoop either. Like that's just how old it was. And like seeing that article. And so I was involved, volunteer with other people in the community, Boys and Girls Club and some other people with the town. And some of the other young players as myself, but we were involved in getting the town to give the money to redo that court. And that's why it was so special. You was there at the summer events that we did the first year. That the courts were redone. So it was amazing, honestly.
It looks great. You know, hopefully, I don't want to get, too political here in the moment or anything. Hopefully we can get those rims and hoops back up in Wareham. So driving by there or Lopes Park, it's a sad sight to see without those rims and backboards up there. So hopefully the town administrators get their act together and, get some hoops and rims back up there for the people.
Hey, if any of us listening, at least one hoop, man, please.
Just one of them, right? That's not asking too much.
We won't go crazy.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Aaron, it wraps up all my questions here. I do like to do this with all my guests, though, here. This is a little bit of a surprise lightning round bit of questions. I like to call it five questions that have nothing to do with sports. I ask you the question, you respond with, whatever is the first thing that comes to mind, okay?
Okay.
So we'll put you, put on the Jeopardy music in the background, so number one, what was the last book or movie that you saw or read?
Crushing It by Gary V.
Oh, Gary Vaynerchuk, big Gary V guy. I love him. Positivity, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Great.
That was
I read.
Yep.
I'm a big in a past life when I used to cover the New York Jets. Gary Vaynerchuk, big New York Jets fan. I got an opportunity to interview him once.
You did?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Very nice guy. Yeah, because he was a couple of the guys that I worked with were like entrepreneurial mindset, so they followed him back from his like wine videos that he used to do back in the day in New Jersey. yeah. Exactly. So he came on the Jets show. Hosted something with the New York Jets. He came on and talked Jets with us for a little bit. So that was definitely fun. Gary V, great guy.